She stared at Holmes and Watson. What does it all mean? Watson shook his head but did not answer. Even Holmes was silent. Is anyone not a member of this society? Asked Diana. We seem to be running into it wherever we go. Van Helsing and this Arminius he mentioned? Seward and his friend Prendick? Rappaccini, Moreau, and the president of the society, whoever that might be, said Mary. We're up to 7, but there are certainly more. You can't have a scientific society, even a secret one, with only 7 members. And if there's a conference...
It seems as though Moreau is dead, said Holmes. But clearly the others are continuing the work of the society, amid some controversy, it seems. How that work is linked to the murders, if it is, I do not know. Van Helsing and Seward could scarcely have been murdering women in Whitechapel if they are in Amsterdam, as Balfour told us. And that would explain this unopened letter. Presumably it was sent before a situation arose that necessitated Seward's presence. Clearly it does not anticipate his trip to Amsterdam. Let me see it for a moment, if you please, Miss Jekyll.
Mary handed him the letter.
Van Helsing writes, "The change did not seem to be taking effect, and when it did, the alteration was so drastic that I thought I would lose her altogether. But in the last month, all has worked as I have wished. Perhaps it stopped working, and that's why Seward was summoned, likely by telegram."
"What stopped working?" asked Diana. "And who's she? Are they poisoning another girl?"
"Perhaps they have confederates in England," said Watson.
"Or perhaps they're not in Amsterdam at all and the summons was a ruse. Perhaps they're the ones who are really killing women in Whitechapel," said Mary.
Diana frowned.
"You're giving me a headache."
"One thing can't be denied," said Watson. "Wherever we turn, we run up against this society. What now, Holmes?"
"Well, at least that's obvious," said Diana. "We need poison breath to tell us what's going on. We need to break her out."
"Yes," said Holmes. "That does seem to be indicated. And as Watson has pointed out, we can scarcely show up at the lady's residence before dark. Miss Jekyll, could you oblige us with dinner? Whatever your cook can provide? It would allow us to look through your father's papers more closely, if you will allow it."
"Yes, of course," said Mary. Whatever her cook could provide. As though she had a cook. And was there enough food in the house for 2 men? She imagined they would want a proper meal. Men did, didn't they? She wished that she could have spoken to Mrs. Poole before leaving for Purfleet. At least she had money now. She put her hand on her purse and almost patted it, in the comforting knowledge that it contained a whole pound in change. But would it do her any good? By the time they reached the house, the shops would be closed. Perhaps Mrs. Poole could send for something from a pub. But there was to be no time for a reading of the letters, not that day. At Fenchurch Street they found a hackney carriage, the kind popularly known as a growler for the noise of its wheels on the cobbled streets, to take them back to Park Terrace. As they jolted along the London thoroughfares, on which the lamps had already been lit, Mary wondered if she would be facing the wrath of Mrs. Poole, left with no information as to where they had gone or when they would be back, and expected to produce dinner as though by magic. Mrs. Poole.
Wrath. Well, I never. When have any of you ever faced my wrath?
Justine.
Yesterday.
Beatrice.
You remember, Mrs. Poole, when you realized we hadn't cleaned up in the parlour after our meeting with Prince Rupert?
Mrs. Poole.
Well, I can't abide it when you girls leave a mess. It's just me and Alice looking after the lot of you, as you know. It's not as though we have any other servants in the house. Alice was up until all hours sweeping up the broken glass.
Alice.
I don't mind, Mrs. Poole.
Mary.
We were trying to capture the masked men who had shot at the prince. We would have caught them, too, if they hadn't jumped on the back steps of an omnibus. Why is it that one can never find a cab in London when one really needs it? And when we got back, we had to take care of Prince Rupert, who had fainted on the sofa. I'm sorry. We would have cleaned it up the next morning. It was just the glass cover for the wax flowers. I'm afraid the flowers are shot to bits, though. And I think there's a hole in one of Justine's paintings.
Beatrice.
I never liked those flowers anyway. I would not have shot at them, of course. But now we can buy something new at Harrods. Something modern, in the style they call l'art nouveau.
Mary.
As soon as you start speaking French, I know it's going to be expensive.
Mrs. Poole.
In my day, young ladies had nothing to do with masked men or princes or madcap chases through the streets. I can't stop you from having these adventures, but I insist on keeping a decent house.
As the carriage drove up to 11 Park Terrace, Charlie leaped off the steps where he had been waiting.
"Mr. Holmes," he said. "Old Carrot Top wants you right away. There's been another murder."
"Another?" said Watson. "How is that possible? Renfield has been under observation since he returned to Purfleet. Did he somehow manage to escape?"
"I don't know about any Renfield," said Charlie. "But this afternoon another doxy was killed. Same way as the last one. And her brain was missing."
"What?" said Holmes sharply. "Are you quite certain?"
"That's what Carrot Top told me. Inspector Lestrade, I mean. I ain't seen her for myself. He found Tommy in front of Scotland Yard and sent him to find me. He said to bring you as soon as I could. I figured you'd be coming back here or to Baker Street. Tommy's watching for you there."
If her brain was taken, that's the first time any of these crimes have been repeated, said Mary.
"So you noticed that as well," said Holmes. "Watson, stay with Miss Jekyll and her sister. I'll be back as soon as I can. Driver, can you take me to Scotland Yard?" "Aye, sir. Hop on back in," said the driver,
and then Holmes was off again. They stood looking at the back of the carriage as it drove away from them down the street.
"Well," said Mary. It was all she could think of to say. Suddenly the door opened behind them.
"Where have you been?" said Mrs. Poole.
Dinner consisted of Irish stew, since Mrs. Poole did not consider cold meats sufficient for a gentleman of Dr. Watson's reputation. Mary said it would take too long, but
"I made it this morning," said Mrs. Poole. "I thought it would be cheap and last several days for you girls. It'll just be a matter of warming it up, and I bought some rolls at Maudie's. Ladies may go hungry, but gentlemen have to eat, you know."
She was rather intimidated by Watson and bustled around making sure he was comfortable. She even whispered to Mary that they should open a bottle of Dr. Jekyll's port. They ate in the dining room, with its large mahogany table, which had not been used in how many years? Mary could not remember. How strange it was to sit there now with Watson and Diana.
Mrs. Poole.
"Me? Intimidated by Dr. Watson? Stuff and nonsense."
Justine. "Is there really a hole in my painting? The one of the girl holding sunflowers? I was hoping to sell that one at the Grosvenor."
The stew was a success, filling and hearty with beef and potatoes and carrots. Watson thanked Mrs. Poole for the port, but would accept only a glass, and insisted that Mary have a glass as well.
"You'll need it to keep your spirits up tonight," he said. "It will be cold and dark, and our mission is dangerous."
"What about me?" said Diana.
I need my spirits kept up too, you know.
Your spirits are already high enough, said Mary. They ate as quickly as they could, punctuated by Diana's slurping and Mary's,
for goodness sake, stop that. It's a disgusting habit.
As they sat at the table over the remains of dinner and empty coffee cups, Watson said,
Are you ladies ready?
As ready as we'll ever be, I suppose, said Mary. However am I going to tell Mrs. Poole what we're up to?
I find the direct way's always best, said Watson.
So when Mrs. Poole came back into the dining room to clear the table, Mary said,
Mrs. Poole, I'm afraid we're going out again tonight. Beatrice Rappaccini, the girl in the advertisement, is being held captive near Lincoln's Inn Fields, and we need to rescue her.
Well, wrap up warmly, said Mrs. Poole. I don't want either of you catching a cold.
Either of us, said Diana.
Yes, either of you, said Mrs. Poole. With a cold, you'd be even more trouble than you are now, Miss Scamp.
Mary, you didn't object at all, Mrs. Poole.
Mrs. Poole,
there was someone needed rescuing. I've never objected when it's really important, have I?
They took a cab toward Lincoln's Inn Fields, asking the cabbie to let them out on High Holborn Street. From High Holborn, they turned into a smaller street. It was Searle, Mary remembered from that morning, although she could not have seen the sign at this hour. The streets were lit, and they walked along the pavement through pools of lamplight, but the park at the centre of the square was a tangle of shadows cast by tree limbs. She held Watson's arm so they would look like a married couple, with Diana as their daughter. As they passed the house Beatrice had pointed out to Mary and Diana earlier that day, they noticed a light in one of the ground floor windows.
I'm going to see who's there, said Diana.
Before Mary could object, Diana had scampered over the front railing and crept to the window, pulling herself up to look over the sill. In a moment she was back.
Professor Petronius and a woman are sitting at a table counting money. And there's a dog, a big black one, sleeping by the fire. Beatrice isn't there.
Don't ever do that again, said Mary.
You can't simply go off by yourself whenever you want to. We have to work together. We have to follow a plan.
Well, what's your plan then? Said Diana, crossing her arms.
She told us her room was in the back, and they locked her in at night. She's probably there now, locked in. We need to go around to the back.
They walked down Searle Street, and at the end of the block of houses turned into an alley. On one side were the backs of the houses on Searle, on the other were the backs of the houses on the next street over. Here there were no lamps. The only light came from the windows, mostly dark at this hour. One of the windows at the back of Professor Petronius's house was lit, but it was on the second floor.
That may be her room, said Mary. She may be looking for us tonight, and the light may be her signal.
So now what? Asked Diana. What's your plan now, sister?
I don't know, said Mary. Let me think.
We need to communicate with her, said Watson. But I don't see any way of getting up there. If only we had a sweeps ladder.
Could we throw up some pebbles and see if she notices? Perhaps she'll come to the window.
We don't know if that's her room, said Mary. Or if she's alone in it. No, we need to get up there somehow.
Oh, fiddlesticks for you and your plans, said Diana.
Before Mary could stop her, she had run over to the wall of the house, silently as a cat, and crouched down in the shadows.
What is she doing?
Whispered Mary urgently.
I believe she's taking off her clothes, said Watson.
What? Taking off what?
Sure enough, Diana was removing her hat, gloves, coat, boots, and stockings. Mary could see her in the dim light that came from the window.
standing beside the wall in only her dress and bare feet. Then she clutched at the drain pipe that ran down the wall and began climbing, pulling herself up the pipe with her bare hands and feet, now and then supporting herself by putting her toes on the joints.
"She looks like a monkey," said Mary. "I'm afraid she'll fall."
"A monkey would not," said Watson. "And judging by her agility, I don't think your sister will either."
Mary could not see his expression in the darkness, but he sounded amused. Mary shivered. It was not the cold, for the night was warm, at least for a late spring night in London. No, it was the sight of Diana climbing up the drainpipe in that primitive way. Wasn't Diana her sister, and Hyde's daughter? What sorts of experiments had her father been conducting to turn himself into Hyde? What had Hyde been? And what, pray tell, was his daughter? She remembered how shocked Beatrice had been to learn that Diana was Hyde's child. What had the girl inherited from her father, other than his unpleasant temperament? When Diana reached the second floor, she let go of the pipe and crept along a narrow ledge to the window. Mary could see her silhouetted against the square of light. Then a face appeared.
"That's Beatrice," said Mary.
The window was pulled up, and Diana crawled in.
"What is she doing? I don't like this."
But in a few minutes Diana reappeared, climbing out the window and letting herself back down the drainpipe. At the bottom she gathered her discarded clothes.
"What did you think you were doing?" said Mary when she rejoined them.
Diana sat on the muddy stones, pulling on her stockings and shoes.
"You wouldn't have let me go up, but I knew I could," said Diana. "I used to climb out of my window at the Magdalen Society all the time. I went inside and picked her lock. When Professor Petronius and the landlady go to bed, she's going to try to get out. The dog is the landlady's. She takes it down with her and locks it in the kitchen when she's asleep. I told her we would be waiting in the park."
They walked back to Searle Street and then across to Lincoln's Inn Fields. There they waited, sitting on one of the park benches, watching the light in the ground floor window. Eventually it went out, but there was still no Beatrice.
"How long do we have to wait?" asked Diana. "I'm bored."
"As long as it takes," said Mary. "She may not be able to get out tonight, in which case we'll have to come back. I hope she can find the front door key."
"It can't be far from the door, in case of fire," said Watson. "I'm more concerned that Professor Petronius will find her searching for it and guard her even more closely in the future."
They waited for what seemed like hours. Once Mary looked at her wristwatch, but she could not see its face in the darkness. At last the front door opened, and a cloaked figure emerged. It was Beatrice. Although there was a hood drawn over her hair, Mary could see her face in the light of the nearby street lamp. She closed the door carefully behind her, then hurried down the steps and toward the park. As she reached the darkness under the trees, she looked around frantically.
"Here," said Mary, keeping her voice low.
Beatrice was so close, only a few feet away from the bench. Beatrice started.
"Oh, I'm so glad to see you," she said. "Let us go quickly. Professor Petronius was snoring when I left, and I believe that woman is asleep as well. But her room is near the kitchen, so I could not see or hear. I do not want either of them to realize I am missing."
"Well, someone's awake," said Diana. "Look at the light."
And Diana was right. When they looked back at the house, they could see that the fanlight, formerly dim, was now glowing. Someone had turned up the gas. Had Beatrice's absence been noticed? If not, it might be at any moment. And then they heard the dog bark.
"Run," said Mary. "Follow the path on the right."
She turned and started running down the path that curved around the park, with the hedge on her right and tall trees to her left. It seemed safer than the long straight path that led to the gazebo, and would take them to the corner near the Royal College of Surgeons. There, she remembered, was another street leading back, she was almost sure, to High Holborn. That was their escape. She turned back to make sure the others were following. Diana darted past her, and she could see Watson trying to help Beatrice, who waved him off, making certain even as she ran that he did not touch her. Mary turned to catch up with Diana. They ran through the shadows, their boots landing with dull thuds on the dirt path. Then the Royal College of Surgeons loomed up on their left. To their right was the opening in the gate, and the road Mary had noticed that morning. They were almost there, almost at the street that led to their escape, and still there was no pursuit. Suddenly they heard a sound that struck a chill into all their hearts. Diana.
Not mine.
Mary. I don't believe that for a minute. It was the dog, barking and growling in the open air. It had been let out, and was making straight for them across the grass under the trees. They could see it as a vague black shape in the darkness, but mostly they could hear it, drawing closer.
I hate to shoot a dog, said Watson. But in this case I have no choice.
No, said Beatrice. A pistol shot will merely draw more attention to us. Fidelis knows me. Let me handle him.
Madam, I think that would be unwise, said Watson.
But Beatrice had already turned back. She was holding her hands out to the large black dog, who approached her warily with barks, but refrained from attacking.
Fidelis, sweet Fidelis, she said coaxingly. Come to me, sweetheart. Who gave you gingerbread yesterday?
Evidently Fidelis remembered the gingerbread. He stopped barking and drew nearer. Beatrice put her hand on his head, then leaned down and breathed on him, long and steadily over his entire face. The black dog sat, then lay down as though tired, and twitched for a moment, and then he was still. Beatrice looked up at them, and even in the darkness, Mary could see that her face was wet with tears.
I did not mean to. Oh, he has made me too poisonous. I meant only to render Fidelis unconscious for a while.
Madam, that was a most impressive demonstration, said Watson.
This isn't the time for compliments, said Mary. Could Watson not see how upset Beatrice was? And what did she mean? Who had made her too poisonous? But this was no time to inquire.
To the right and up the street. We need to lose ourselves in the crowd.
They ran up the street, emerging on King's Way, then merged with the crowd as best they could, heading toward Piccadilly Circus. Although it was late, Mary checked her watch again and found that it was after midnight. The roads were still choked with carts and wagons. On the sidewalks, beggars asked for pence, and fancily dressed women greeted potential customers, which was all the better for them. There was less of a chance they would be seen in the London traffic. At Piccadilly Circus, they caught a hackney carriage.
"You must lower the windows," said Beatrice. "Cover your mouths with handkerchiefs. And do not breathe too deeply. Forgive me. I would change my nature if I could. I shall always be what I am, a danger to others. But my toxicity will lessen with time. Professor Petronius insisted that I ingest poison every day, to make certain I would kill his specimens as effectively and dramatically as possible. Tonight, I am sorry to say, it has ensured our escape. Under ordinary circumstances, I could not have killed Fidelis so quickly. Would that he had survived. He was a good creature, and did only as his master bade him.
How terrible, said Mary.
She and Watson pulled down the windows, none too soon because she was beginning to feel light-headed. Luckily, she had an extra handkerchief for Diana, who had, of course, forgotten hers.
Why did you stay with him if he treated you so badly?
I was told the college would find a way to make me ordinary, not mortal to my kind. I hoped it was true, but came to realize that his sole motive was profit. The college was benefiting from his fees. There was no incentive to cure my condition.
Beatrice looked out the window, taking in the sights and sounds of London at night, the rows of gas lamps, the continual life of the city, cabs and carts, and gentlemen's broughams moving through the streets, even at this late hour.
It's magnificent, she said. I've seen so little of London since I've been here. Before arriving, I spent several weeks in Paris, hoping the French physicians, so famous for their art, could find a cure for me, but to no avail. I had already been to Milan and Vienna, so I came to the largest city in the world, hoping that here, if nowhere else, I could be cured. By the time I arrived, I had no money left, and Professor Petronius offered me a way to at least keep body and soul together. At first he wanted to put me in a freak show and tour through the countryside, but displaying me as a scientific oddity proved more lucrative. So here I am, still with no way to sustain myself, and no cure for my condition. Ah, sometimes I wish that I had died in Padua.
Don't say that, said Mary.
You're among friends now. We'll help you as best we can.
But how could she help the poisonous girl? A perfume seemed to emanate from Beatrice, like the scent of an exotic flower. That's the poison, she thought. She put her head out the window to gulp mouthfuls of London air, with its miasma of coal dust, manure, and the general doings of 6 million inhabitants. Still, it was preferable to Beatrice's sweet toxicity.
They were almost at Marylebone, she noticed with relief. Soon they would be home, and then what?
The house was dark when Mary let them all in, but almost immediately Mrs. Poole came bustling up from the kitchen.
I've been waiting up, watching for you, she said. This must be the Italian lady. You're most welcome here, miss.
Thank you, said Beatrice. And I apologize for any trouble I have caused, or am about to cause. It is most kind of you to welcome me into this beautiful home.
Mrs. Poole. Now that's manners, that is. If you had been so polite, Miss Diana, you would have gotten a different reception.
Oh, stuff it, said Diana. The question is, where is she going to sleep? I don't want her anywhere near me. I just about threw up in the carriage.
I must sleep far away from any of you, said Beatrice. What is the most distant part of the house?
My father's laboratory, said Mary. It's across the courtyard. Mrs. Poole, can you make up a bed for Beatrice in there for the night?
She could sleep on the sofa in his office, said Mrs. Poole. Dr. Jekyll often slept there when conducting his experiments. I'll bring up a pillow and some blankets. I finished cleaning and airing it out today, so at least it won't be dusty for you, miss.
Before bidding them good night, Watson said to Mary,
You will be careful, won't you? Miss Rappaccini is a lovely woman. I have seldom seen anyone more beautiful. But I do not want her to make you and your sister ill. If the responsibility becomes too much, Holmes and I will find other accommodations for her.
That's very kind of you, said Mary.
Let us see how the night goes. I'll know better in the morning what is to be done.
After making sure the other girls were both taken care of, and before going to bed herself, Mary remembered to give Mrs. Poole half the money she had taken out of the bank that morning. Half a pound would keep them in groceries for a while. But when she was lying in bed, she could not sleep. Diana was snoring in the nursery, and no doubt Beatrice was bedded down in her father's office on the other side of the courtyard. She stared into the darkness, feeling a sickness that had nothing to do with Beatrice's poison. What was this secret society that seemed to have its members everywhere? What experiments were those members conducting? If she included the most recent murder, 5 girls had been killed and parts of their bodies removed. Why? She had a sense of something wrong in the order of things, some evil. She remembered having felt it once before. Yes, when she was a child. That night, when she had seen the face of Edward Hyde. When she finally fell asleep, she had dreams she did not wish to remember the next morning, of women with their heads or arms or legs missing, stumbling or dragging themselves through the streets of London, calling if they had mouths, gesturing if they had hands. But she could not hear what they were calling, or understand what, if anything, they were trying to tell her. Chapter 10. Beatrice's Story. The next morning they gathered for breakfast in the morning room, which had a table just large enough to seat 4. It was the room where Mary's mother had done accounts before she had become too ill to manage the household. Afterward, Mary had taken over. Each morning she would sit at her mother's desk, going over the books, making sure the bills were paid, her mother taken care of. It was strange to sit in that room now, across the table from Diana. Beatrice perched on a chair by the window, which was open at the bottom. Through the window, Mary could see the bleak courtyard. Diana could not keep from yawning. She would have to be taught to put her hand in front of her mouth. Beatrice looked pale but seemed composed. She said she had spent a perfectly comfortable night on the sofa in the office. Breakfast was buttered toast, poached eggs, and good strong tea for Mary and Diana. "I went marketing this morning with the money you gave me," Mrs. Poole had told Mary. "Fresh from the country those eggs are. Look at the yolks. I paid Mr. Biles, so he can't give me any more of his nasty looks. There will be cakes for tea if that devil of an oven cooperates. I was at a loss for what to give Miss Rappaccini, though I asked her last night what she would like for breakfast. Water in which organic matter has been steeped, please, she tells me, as nice as you please. And what might that be, miss? I asked her. Well, I've done my best, but it's a queer diet, and no mistake. Beatrice warmed her hands around a steaming mug. It was all she would take for breakfast. I have no need of food, you see. Only the nutrients themselves, and sunlight. It will take several days for the strong poisons to leave my system. The dandelion greens I picked in the courtyard will help with the detoxification process. Until then, we will need to be particularly careful. Do not touch me, and I will try to keep away from you as much as I can. Once the strong poisons are out, I will be toxic, but not to such a degree. My breath will be able to kill only the smallest living beings. Insects, birds, mice, and voles. After spending some time in a closed room with me, you will begin to feel faint, but I will not be lethal unless we are in close contact. Still, my touch will burn, as though you had touched a strong alkaloid. You seem to know a great deal about yourself, said Mary. It is through sad experience, said Beatrice. If only I knew how to cure myself. Although my father taught me many things, he could not teach me that. He did not know himself. I asked him. At one time I even begged him to cure me. But he told me that as far as he knew, the condition was irreversible. He said I should be proud of my nature,
which made me unique among womankind. "Why don't you tell us about it?" asked Mary.
Catherine, yes, you do need to write the section about yourself. You all promised that you would write your own stories.
Beatrice,
but my English is not so good.
You know the whole story, Cat. Why can you not write it? You are the writer among us. You would make it, you know, lively. Truly, I cannot write it.
Catherine, well, you have to. I have a deadline for Astarte and the Idol of God, and I won't get the advance until I turn it in. At least write the first draft. Your English is perfectly fine, and anyway I'll make everything sound right in revision. Come on, I'll ask Mrs. Poole to make you some of that disgusting weed tea you like so much.
Beatrice,
it's quite good, you know, very refreshing.
Diana,
I've tried it. I had to spit it out. It tasted like warm piss.
Catherine, as though you would know.
Come on, Beatrice. Here's the pen. Sit down like a good poisonous plant and start writing. I'll fix it all later.
I never knew my mother, said Beatrice. She was the daughter of a poor man, a farmer in the hills around Padua, and much younger than my father. I believe he married her principally because of her youth and beauty. His goal was to have a daughter, to have me. A son would have been less useful to him. He would have raised a son as his apprentice to continue his scientific studies. But a daughter could be both an apprentice and a subject for his experiments. My father was a physician, the greatest in Padua, perhaps in Italy. Patients would come from all over the country to be healed by the famous Dr. Rappaccini. On her father's farm, my mother had been used to tending a garden. She tended my father's garden, and I have often wondered if she was weakened by constant contact with his pharmacopoeia, the poisonous plants he grew and from which he made his medicines. For, as he often told me, poison is in the dose, and a poison in the human body can be cured only by a poison from the external world. Digitalis, the active ingredient of the common foxglove, kills a healthy man, but cures one who is sick in his heart. As she tended his poisonous plants, I grew in her belly, absorbing their poisons. I believe they affected me even in the womb. While they weakened her, I was so imbued by their essence that they made me strong and healthy. On the day I was born, she died, giving birth to me. Already weakened, she could not bear the rigors of childbirth. She was a farmer's daughter, and I was a monster. I hold myself responsible for her death. You must not think that way, said Mary.
Why? Asked Diana.
She's probably right, you know. I'm not saying it's her fault, but her mother died giving birth to her. Facts is facts.
My father did not hire a wet nurse, continued Beatrice. I suckled at certain plants that nourished me as a nurse would have. As a child, I thought my father and I were the only beings in the world, and our garden walls were the limits of that world. There was a woman who lived in the house next to ours, a Signora Lisabetta. One of her windows overlooked our garden, and I sometimes saw her peering over our wall, but having seen her only from the torso up, I did not regard her as a person, and assumed she was an angel who sometimes looked down on me. For years I played happily with my sisters, the flowers, and was sad that I could not play with the butterflies, crickets, or worms, but they died when I came too close. Eventually I learned the world was much larger than I had realized, that there were people in it like me, yet not like me. My father did not keep my nature a secret. He explained to me that I was poisonous to others of my kind. He told me with no hesitation or shame. Nay, he gloried in it. I was the perfect woman, he told me, more beautiful and stronger than ordinary women. I would entice men, but they could never touch me. I did not question his actions or motives. He was my father, and I believed he loved me. Indeed, I helped him with his experiments, and he told me all about the work of the Société des Alchimistes. He hoped that one day I would become a member, both as a scientist and as living evidence of his theories of transmutation.
Transmutation, said Mary, leaning forward. That's what your father's letter mentioned. Experiments in transmutation. Wait just a minute.
She had left the portfolio in her mother's desk. It occurred to her for the first time that she should have locked the desk drawer. She would have to find the key. Now she stood and went over to the desk, pulled the portfolio out of the drawer, put it on the table, and took out all the documents. There was the letter from Italy. She read it to Beatrice.
Transmutation, not natural selection, is the agent of evolution. I am pleased to report that my Beatrice is flourishing. Our colleague Moreau was right to conjecture that the female brain would be more malleable and responsive to our experiments. What are these experiments in transmutation? What does it all mean? Do you know?
Beatrice took the letter from Mary. For a long moment she could only look at it, her hand trembling and her eyes filling with tears. Clearly she was thinking about her father. At last she looked up.
I do, alas, she said,
wiping her eyes with one hand.
You know, of course, of the medieval alchemists.
No, said Diana.
Yes, of course, said Mary. They tried to turn lead into gold.
That was the medieval idea of transmutation, said Beatrice. One form of matter turned into another. In the Middle Ages, alchemists were considered magicians and burned at the stake. But truly they were scientists. What occupied them more than anything else was the search for eternal life, the transmutation of the dead into the living. And so they began to experiment on biological matter. A century ago, a university student named Victor Frankenstein proved that it could be done, that dead matter could once again be brought to life. He paid a terrible price for the success of his experiments. But my father believed his aims could be achieved by other means. Frankenstein was his inspiration, and the inspiration for those who, like him, wished to transmute not base metals, but human beings. My father sent papers about me to the Société. He often complained about what he called the traditionalists, the anti-evolutionists who believed that man was divinely created, that transmutation of the human was against God's plan. Evolution is the greatest discovery of our age, he would tell me. We evolved from the apes. What may we yet evolve into? The forces of natural selection are no longer acting on man, so it has become our duty to direct evolution, to create the higher forms that man will become. But do they see that? No, they do not. The grandi idioti. He would wave his hands, shouting, idioti, idioti. Thus would he speak of the traditionalists in the Société. But he and his colleagues were working on advancing evolution through transmutation. They believed they were assisting the species, unasked and unappreciated, to rise higher. And so they were trying to transform girls into... what? Asked Mary. What were they doing? And why would it require murder? These girls who've been killed in Whitechapel. They had limbs missing. Why would transmutation require that?
Beatrice looked at her with astonishment.
Missing limbs? From girls murdered in Whitechapel? But that does not make sense. There is only one reason to take limbs. But the experiment is ancient, 100 years old. It is Frankenstein's original experiment. Why would anyone want to recreate his experiment in this day and age? The experiments of my father and his colleagues were subtle and theoretically sophisticated. They sought to advance humanity in particular directions.
My father wished to strengthen humanity through the incorporation of plant essences. Dr. Moreau and your father were exploring what separates the human and animal in an attempt to raise the human even higher, above our animal natures. They were attempting to refine and purify humanity. Their goals were noble, and when I was young, I thought they were the wisest men in the world, that they would lead us to a new golden age. Since then, I have come to question their methods. But this matter of the missing limbs, I cannot understand it.
She drank the rest of her noxious tea and put the empty mug on the windowsill. Diana shoved the last of her toast and poached egg into her mouth and chewed loudly.
"Well, the girls are dead," said Mary. "And their limbs are missing. Legs, arms, head, and two sets of brains. That's the mystery we've been trying to solve. You said there's only one reason to take limbs from these girls, but you didn't say what it is. What was Frankenstein's original experiment?"
"To take parts of the dead and create a living being," said Beatrice.
"To sew those limbs together into a woman and bring her to life. That is what Frankenstein did, not with a woman, but with a man. A living corpse who became a monster."
"Awesome," said Diana, her mouth open with half-chewed food in it.
"But that's horrible," said Mary. "I can't imagine what would prompt someone to do such a thing."
"The love of science for its own sake," said Beatrice. "But also for the promise it holds of raising us above our limited human selves. Surely you can see the beauty of such an ambition, even if you cannot approve of how it has been pursued. And of course, the murder of 5 women is inexcusable, however noble the aim. But Frankenstein's experiment was crude, inelegant. My father's methods left you poisonous," said Mary. Beatrice simply looked down at her hands, clasped on her lap.
Mary did not know what to do. Had she insulted Beatrice? She had not meant to. But the experiments, they were wrong. Surely they must all agree that the experiments were wrong. Molly Keane, lying on the pavement in her own blood.
Diana belched and wiped her mouth with the back of her hand.
Mary did not reprimand her. She did not know what to say.
"What are those other letters?" asked Beatrice. "Are they also from my father?"
"Oh, those," said Mary. "No, and they're in Latin, so I have no idea what they're about. But they have red seals on them with S.A.
"Bet poison breath knows Latin," said Diana.
"Of course," said Beatrice. "It is the language of science. And the seals were used by members of the Société, including my father, when transacting official business. They signaled that the letters were to be opened at once, and in secret. All members of the Society had such seals, often on pendants or rings. I will approach and examine those letters, if you will allow."
"Of course," said Mary. She made a point of not moving back as Beatrice walked to the table, although Diana retreated to the other side of the room. Beatrice drew the letters toward her across the table.
"Ex Societate Expelleris. These are from the president of the society to your father, warning him that if he continues his experiments he will be expelled. This letter is the first warning. The second one, you see it is dated 6 months later, tells him that the warning is final. It is, as you say, an ultimatum. My father had spoken of Dr. Jekyll's experiments as dangerous."
"What were they, do you know?" asked Mary.
"I have a hypothesis."
"That I do not know. Not specifically," said Beatrice. "My father did not speak of it with me. Only to say that Dr. Jekyll was trying to defeat our animal nature, raise man to new spiritual heights, and that no scientist should experiment on himself."
Mary was disappointed. She had hoped Beatrice would know something. Her father had attempted to defeat his animal nature and had instead become Hyde, the animal.
How? Why?
She sighed, ate the remainder of her toast, and wiped her mouth with a napkin. Perhaps she would never know. Her father had taken his secrets with him to the grave. All but these fragments.
Are we done? Said Diana. Because I'm bored.
They heard the front doorbell ring, and a moment later Mrs. Poole came in.
It's Mr. Holmes and Dr. Watson, she said. They would like a moment of your time. They say, let me see if I've got this right. Renfield has escaped?
Catherine, you haven't said anything about Giovanni. Beatrice,
I don't want to talk about it.
Mary,
but Beatrice, you've left out an important part. I know you don't want to remember what happened, but it's not as though you killed him. You can't take responsibility for what's not your fault.
Beatrice,
but it is my fault.
When I let him into my father's garden, when I walked with him among the poisonous flowers, I was infusing him with the poison, my poison. I did not mean to harm him. I thought if he could become like me, we could be together, and I would not be so alone. And then he died.
Catherine,
but not just like that. Here, let me tell the story. One day, as I was walking through the garden, I looked up, and there, looking down from Signora Elisabetta's window, was the handsomest man I had ever seen. He was a cousin of hers, who had come to Padua to study medicine. Of course, the only other man I had seen was my father, but I have seen men since, and Giovanni was indeed handsome, with crisp, curling brown hair, brown eyes that seemed to contain his soul, and cheeks tanned by the sun of southern Italy.
Beatrice.
Oh, Catherine, please stop. It's enough to say that he was handsome and I loved him. All right, I shall tell the story, if only to keep you from making it sound like one of those romantic serials sold in train stations.
Catherine.
There's nothing wrong with train stations. If it weren't for train stations, the mysteries of Astarte wouldn't have sold nearly as well.
Beatrice.
That is not at all the point. Day after day he would come to visit me in my father's garden. Day after day he walked in a poisonous miasma, not knowing. I knew. Each day I kept him longer talking to him, never touching him, waiting for him to become poisonous, as I was. My father knew of his visits. How could he not? And yet he said nothing. Perhaps he thought Giovanni would form a useful addition to our family. After all, he was a medical student at the University of Padua. He could become another apprentice to the great Dr. Rappaccini. One day, Giovanni noticed that a spider had woven a web in his window. He leaned closer to look, and the spider died from his breath. He realized then what had happened. He was becoming poisonous. He went to see my father's rival in Padua, the physician Pietro Baglioni, who was a professor at the medical school. My father and Baglioni had been medical students together, and he had once been a member of the Société des Alchimistes himself. But he had quarreled with my father and left the society. He knew about me, about my poisonous nature. He concocted what he believed to be an antidote and gave it to Giovanni, telling him that if we drank it, we would be cured. Giovanni brought me the antidote and told me that it would cure us both. We stood in the garden together, not touching. Even then, he did not know I had intended to make him poisonous. He thought it was an accident, that I had not been aware of my own nature. How trusting he was. He loved me and wanted us both to be normal. He did not want to be a monster.
That was the word he used.
He did not want to be separated from humanity. That day I realized what I was. A monster among men.
Mary. You're not a monster, Beatrice. I wish you would stop using that word.
Justine.
Why? If it's technically accurate. We are all monsters in our own way. Even you, Mary. I told him that I did not trust Baglioni as a man or a scientist. I told him we should not drink. But he pleaded with me. I took the glass vial containing the antidote. It was green, the color of emeralds. And then I heard, "No, no, my daughter. Do you not know that Baglioni is my enemy? That he would do anything to destroy my experiments?"
"Father, can't you see what you've done to me?" I said. "I don't want to be deadly to my kind."
"Here, let me show you that it's perfectly safe," said Giovanni. "I will drink first." He took the vial from my hand and drank the emerald liquid. He smiled down at me reassuringly. But then his face contorted with pain and he fell to the ground, writhing, clutching his abdomen. I fell to my knees beside him. I, who had made my father's medicines, did not know what to do, what to give him. I took him in my arms and pleaded with him not to die. But in a moment it was over. Giovanni lay in my arms, dead. I took up the vial he had let fall and drank the remaining antidote, intending to die myself. But nothing happened. The poison in my system was so strong that it had no effect. That night I thought about killing myself. With a knife, perhaps. Did I not deserve death? I had killed the man I loved, as surely as though I had driven a knife through his heart. But I lacked the courage. Instead, the next day I told my father that he must reverse the process. I did not wish to be poisonous any longer, not after killing the man I loved. I wished to be an ordinary woman. That was when he told me the process was irreversible. So I left my father's house and went to the university. I found Professor Baglioni and told him that if he did not find a cure for my condition, I would tell all Padua he had murdered Giovanni. He tried again and again to find an antidote. Not for my benefit, or out of a sense of responsibility for Giovanni's death. No, I believe he was motivated by malice toward my father. Nevertheless, I stayed, living in his house, although he kept well away from me, hoping for a cure or death. There was no one else who knew of my condition, and my father had made it clear that he could not help me, that he wished me to remain as I was, his greatest creation. So I became Baglioni's collaborator, working with my enemy, the man who had caused my lover's death, creating potion after potion in his laboratory. But none of them made me less poisonous. One day, Baglioni came into the laboratory where I was brewing the latest potion. "Your father is dead," he told me. He had been found in his garden among the poisonous plants. Signora Elisabetta had seen him and alerted the authorities. I had left him without a word, and in the weeks I had been staying with Professor Baglioni, he had never come to see me. Always I had been the one to tend his garden. The plants could not harm me. But he was too frail and had succumbed to their poison. Because of his reputation, none dared enter the garden. I was the one who entered it once again and buried him there. As I left my father's house for the last time, Signora Elisabetta leaned out of her window and cursed me. It was only what I deserved.
Justine. Beatrice, that is certainly not true.
Diana.
Why did you even bother going back? I would have left him to rot.
So, you see, I killed my mother and Giovanni. Perhaps I killed my father as well, who knows? Giovanni was right to use the word monster.
Mary.
That's ridiculous. It's not your fault that your mother or Giovanni died, and your father is certainly responsible for his own death. I agree with Justine. Honestly, even Diana...